growing up, I never flew on an airplane. First time on an airplane, I was, I think, 16 years old. And I flew very rarely for about the next 20 years. I think till I was 35, I might have been on 4 trips on an airplane, maybe. And it was fine with me because it kind of freaked me out a little bit. You know, I would get on an airplane, I'd be very conscious of the fact that I'm on a metal tube that just gets launched into the sky. And it just seemed so fragile, so delicate, and unnatural. Taking off, I would get nervous. I wouldn't really get sick, but I would get nervous. We'd hit turbulence and the plane would start bouncing. I'd get nervous. And then landing, my least favorite part. Because those wheels hit the ground and you're suddenly so conscious of just how fast you're going. It doesn't feel like you're going fast when you're up in the sky, but you hit that runway and you realize we're going about 6,000 miles an hour, I think. We're going to test those brakes and see what happens. And I'd always have this sense of relief, like the fact that we made it there alive was a novelty, instead of the fact that these pilots ran this route over and over and over again, day after day, and it was about as mundane as me driving to the grocery store. One thing that helped me overcome my nervousness about flying was I met a guy, became acquainted with a guy who was a pilot. I can't remember what airline he worked for, but his primary job had gone from flying different routes to training pilots. He worked at a big simulator facility. I think it was at the Toledo Airport. And he would train pilots on a variety of scenarios. Scenarios like an engine goes out, or the landing gear is not working, or there's a terrible storm, or whatever. And he would train these pilots over and over and over in these scenarios. All the worst kinds of scenarios. And it wasn't just brand new pilots that hadn't yet flown, but pilots who were regularly running routes to various places, who were required to keep up their training for a variety of scenarios that would almost certainly never happen. But it wouldn't do any good for them to train for some kind of terrible situation, and yet 20 years later is when they face it and they think, what was that thing that I did 20 years ago? And so the airlines will continually make their pilots stay up to date on training for all sorts of things. And once I learned about the rigor, just the continual chasing of proficiency in these pilots, it made me feel a lot more comfortable. Honestly, when I started getting on planes after that, I thought, well, I just had no idea just how committed these pilots are to constantly being at the top of their game. As my respect for the proficiency, the competency of these pilots grew in my own mind, it wasn't that they were more proficient, it's just that my understanding of their proficiency grew. My comfort and my enjoyment of flying also grew. And the same is true as we understand and learn to submit and revere God more. It seems like a paradox, but to fear God more, that is to give him the reverence and the respect and the submission that he deserves, actually leads to a greater sense of comfort and enjoyment in our lives. The more we learn to fear God, that is to revere him and to submit to him, to appreciate his character, his nature, the more we experience joy and satisfaction and peace. That's actually what we're going to learn about today in Psalm 34, if you want to turn there with me. Psalm 34 talks about the fear of the Lord. And the fear of the Lord is not the kind of fear that I had of flying in the early part of my life, which was just this kind of panicked anxiety. But as we find in this psalm, fear of the Lord is something very precious to David. It's not something with a negative connotation at all, but as he understood and appreciated and revered God the way he ought to, it brought him an incredible amount of joy and satisfaction and peace, even in very tumultuous situations. And I hope that as we look at Psalm 34 this morning, the same will be true for us. Psalm 34, if I could summarize it for us, it would say this: the fear of God leads to comfort and security. Comfort and security. And we're going to see three different aspects of this fear, what a God-fearing attitude, a God-fearing posture looks like. And as we do so, I hope it's going to help us evaluate whether this attitude is present in our lives. And if not, we should ask ourselves if we're finding the kind of comfort, the kind of joy, the kind of satisfaction, even in the midst of difficult situations that David experienced, or not. Allow me to read Psalm 34. It says this: of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. O magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days, that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and its ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. As I said, there are three main aspects to fearing God that we see in this passage that lead to comfort, security, and joy, even in terrible circumstances. The first one is this: fearing God involves being satisfied in him. That might sound like funny language to use of God, but I'll explain. First, David starts with an admonition, an invitation, really. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise will continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. And then he says, O magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I'm going to bless the Lord all the time. Why don't you join me? Why is that? David is actually going to spend most of the psalm giving his reasons for why he will bless the Lord at all times and why he invites everyone else to do so. But for now, since this is the beginning of the psalm, let's take a look at what this attitude looks like. First thing that catches our attention in verse 1 is that he says, I will bless the Lord at all times, and his praise shall continually be in my mouth. That is to say, not just when things are pleasant. Like Paul exhorted us this morning to give thanks in all circumstances, not give thanks when the circumstances suit you, but being satisfied in God means saying, I'm going to find my satisfaction in the God who is sovereign over and under and through my situation. Rather than waiting for my situation to be exactly what I want it to be, because if my satisfaction has to come from my circumstances, that's fragile at best. Being satisfied in God means rejoicing in his goodness in every circumstance. It means finding satisfaction in him rather than in our own situation. So in verse 2, his soul makes its boast in the Lord, the humble. Let the humble hear and be glad. David didn't bring glory to himself. David didn't trust in himself. But he entrusted himself to the God in whom, to whom he belonged. Humbly exalting God rather than himself led to gladness. Being humble, recognizing God's sovereignty over his life and his circumstances, led to gladness. And so he says, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. This magnifying, this exalting, wasn't done in isolation. He didn't keep it to himself. David knew that being satisfied in God in community with God's people maximized his joy. He was excited to talk about how good God was even in the midst of hard circumstances. We'll talk in a moment about what those circumstances are as indicated by the introductory statement of this psalm. So before we get to why exactly David could trust and rejoice in God in all of his circumstances, jump down to verse 8 with me. Verse 8 begins with an admonition. Taste and see. Taste and see. Taste the Lord. Doesn't that sound strange? What does that mean to taste God? It sounds almost irreverent. Funny and ironic, especially coming from a psalm that's about the fear of the Lord. This tasting, this word used to taste, is a word that implies that this is not a superficial experience of the Lord. Don't just read about him. Don't just hear other people talking about their experience with the Lord, but experience his goodness for yourself. Tasting here is a metaphor for getting as close as you can. A first-hand experience rather than a third-hand one. As he continues in the second part of verse 8, blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. This is where we learn about being satisfied in God. To be satisfied with him is to say, he is enough. I don't need God plus X to be happy. To be in the Lord and to be given whatever it is that he knows that I need is plenty for me. Can we rejoice in the God to whom we belong even when things are hard? I know it's very easy for me to feel like I have this mantle of godly devotedness when my circumstances suit me. Like, oh, I'm so content in the Lord, when really what it is I'm content in the very pleasant circumstances that God's given me. And the superficiality of that satisfaction is made plain when my circumstances change to something that's not pleasant, that's not my preference, and I realize, wow, I'm actually pretty ungrateful. When we experience difficulty in our lives, we should run to psalms like this, passages like this, to remind us that God is our sufficiency. Fearing God involves being satisfied in Him. Secondly, fearing God involves trusting Him for the strength to persevere. In verse 4, David begins to outline why exactly he wants to rejoice. Well, He answered me. I sought the Lord. He answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. David did not take credit for rescuing himself. Let's talk about the circumstances that he wrote this in. When it says of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away. This was David, while he was on the run from Saul, was brought before another pagan king. And David had led his men into battle against this king's people a number of times before and conquered them. And David was scared. David being captured, brought before this king who was his enemy, and having been captured by people who knew just how dangerous he was, just how valuable a prisoner he was. So David does something rather clever. As these men are bringing him before the king, he decides to act crazy. He acts like this muttering crazy guy. It even says he's drooling on himself. And so the king says, do I have need for another madman? Do I need another crazy person? What good is this guy to me? He's obviously off his rocker. And so they send him away. And David is relieved. And it's interesting that David doesn't say, I'm so glad I got out of that situation by my own cleverness. He did not take credit for rescuing himself out of that situation. Even though it'd be easy at one level to read that story and say, wow, David was a clever, strategic thinker. David says, I was scared and God rescued me. And so in verse 5, he says, those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. Makes me think of Moses. When Moses went into the tent of meeting to talk with God, he would come out and his face shone. It was plain that he had been face to face with God. And it disturbed the people. They said, can you actually put something over your face? That kind of freaks us out. Just funny to think. Can you just put a, he had to put a veil over his face because they didn't like it. Because he looked so different. Because he was the one guy who stood face to face with God and talked with him. Being with God, knowing him, cultivating intimacy with him, gives a radiance to our lives that testifies to his power, testifies to his goodness. People can see it. When we trust him for the strength to persevere, what we do is we glorify him by showing that we are living differently because of the grace that he provides. Now in verses 6 and 7, he says, this poor man cried and the Lord heard him, saved him out of all his troubles. He said that in verse 4 also. He delivered me from all my fears. Verse 7, The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. What's interesting here is God rescued David from this king. But that didn't mean that everything in his life was set back to this perfect, pleasant situation. He was still being hunted by Saul. The idea was not that David rejoiced in God once he solved all of his problems. But he celebrated the tangible examples of God's love and faithfulness, even in the midst of an overarching, difficult situation. Let's never think that to be a Christian means we won't suffer difficulty, that we won't experience hardship. One thing that can often compound our suffering is when we think that we must be suffering because we've done something wrong. Sometimes our suffering is a result of our own sin, and it's good to examine that. But more times than not, it's not. It is just in God's sovereignty, this suffering has come into our lives, in whatever situation it is. And it is an opportunity for us to seek the Lord and find joy that's deeper than our circumstances. Jump toward the end. Verse 19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. It's good to affirm that truth, but it's also good for us to think about that statement made in the first part of verse 19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. If you are among God's people, you are the righteous that David's talking about here. And he's saying, if you are one of God's people, you're going to suffer a lot. You just are. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. As Jesus said, in this life you will have trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world, he says. But it's important for us to note that Jesus says, like David, bad stuff is going to happen to you. So if you've got this idea of Christianity where you will rejoice in the Lord as long as everything's fine, then you're going to be a fair-weather Christian if ever there was one, because many are the afflictions of the righteous. But the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. God will ultimately deliver us from our afflictions. It is not a cop-out to yearn for heaven. The old adage that those who are too heavenly-minded are no earthly good could not be less true. That could not be a more false statement. Because in God's economy, those who are the most heavenly-minded do the most earthly good. And it's not a cop-out to yearn for that. It's not a cop-out to long for the joy of experiencing total freedom from pain and sadness. It's at the heart of the gospel. But we can also honestly and earnestly pray that God would deliver us from difficult circumstances now. That's fine. If you have some kind of prolonged sickness, it's perfectly acceptable to say, God, I wish that you would take this away from me. There's nothing sinful about that. But understanding that he may or may not, and that his purpose in our suffering is that we would learn to trust him for strength to persevere. Fearing God involves being satisfied with him. Fearing God involves trusting him for strength to persevere. Fearing God involves trusting in his love. Look at verses 15 and 16. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears hear their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The eyes of the Lord are toward one group of people and against another group of people. If we're not Christians, if we're not united with Christ through grace, by faith, we're under God's condemnation. In other words, we do not want to be a part of the group of people in verse 16. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. But if we're in Christ, we're a part of the verse 15 people. We can rest in the knowledge of his love. He has our good in mind, and he cares when we're suffering. A friend of mine not long ago, when I was talking with him about trying to navigate a difficult situation for our family, he said, "You know, Vinny, you have to remember that God loves your family more than you do." I said, that's a good word. As we see in verses 17 and 18, when the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears, delivers them out of all their troubles. In verse 18, the Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. If you are experiencing trouble or suffering or difficulty, God is not indifferent. He's not indifferent. He cares for us more than we understand. And one of the aspects of fearing God that helps bring comfort in the midst of difficulty is trusting in his love, trusting that his character is consistent. Knowing that suffering does not mean that God is indifferent, doesn't mean that God is angry with us. But that even in the midst of that difficulty, even as we can trust him for power, for strength to persevere in difficulty, we can trust that his love is consistent. I think at the beginning of this sermon, I said that there are three aspects to fearing God that we see in this passage. That was not quite true. There are four. Fearing God involves being satisfied in him. Fearing God involves trusting him for the strength to persevere. Fearing God involves trusting in his love. Finally, fearing God involves living in godliness. Verse 11, David goes in a direction that at least I wouldn't necessarily expect. He says, "Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." All of a sudden, this sounds like the beginning of Proverbs. But there is a natural connection here. When we understand who God is and how worthy he is of our submission, of our allegiance, we begin to understand that fearing him must have an effect on the way that we live. To fear him means to learn to live differently. And this is not arbitrary. To live in godliness under the fear of the Lord is not to live in fear of being struck with punishment or whatever. But it's in our best interest. Because David gives us a rhetorical question in verse 12. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? This is a rhetorical question because you would think the answer would be everyone. Who wants to have a full, rich life marked by God's goodness and faithfulness? If you want this, then learn to live in the fear of the Lord. Learn to walk in godliness. We understand that living in godliness is synonymous with wisdom. When we went through Proverbs a little over a year ago, on Thursday nights, we learned that wisdom and foolishness, as characterized in Proverbs, are not quite what the world would view wisdom and foolishness as. And wisdom, according to Proverbs, starts with the fear of the Lord. That's the origin. And all real wisdom grows out of a fear of the Lord. Foolishness is exaltation of self and dismissing fear of God as really that valuable. Real wisdom is saying, I affirm that God is who he says he is. Therefore, it makes no sense for me to live as if that's not true. It makes no sense for me to make decisions in my work, in my finances, in my relationships, in my management of time, with any other starting point other than God is the God of everything, and he is to be feared. Because that's in our best interest. In verses 13 and 14, he gives some practical pictures of what that looks like. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace. Pursue it. There's an active sense here. The life of godliness means battling our sinful tendencies. It means saying, I am going to live differently. I cannot just give in to my sinful impulses. I'm going to fight them. There are certain sinful, selfish, self-centered ways, idolatrous ways that I'm inclined to handle certain situations, big and small. But instead, I'm going to choose, by God's grace, to live and think and act and talk in a way that brings glory to the God who I'm submitted to. In Isaiah chapter 61, the first three verses is a prophecy about Jesus. 700 years before Jesus is born, Isaiah paints a beautiful picture throughout this book of who the Messiah would be. This is one of those passages. Jesus later explicitly says, "This passage is about me." Says this, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance on our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified." Jesus was sent to demonstrate God's love in tangible ways, culminating in his death and resurrection, his love to sinners like us, and to be glorified in it, to be exalted in it. And the more clearly we see that glory, the more clearly, the more fully we appreciate it, the more joy that we can experience in this life, the more comfort we can experience in this life as we grow in our satisfaction in him, as we grow in our desire to live in a way that honors him, and as we rest more fully in his grace. Let's pray.